Well, thanks for joining me briefly here today this morning. There's a lot, as you saw on the roster, there's a lot about physician training, and what I want to do is sort of start off, luckily I'm first, so I get to sort of start off and expand your mind as far as what medical education can mean and health professions training can mean, because I myself am a physician assistant. I teach PAs, but I've taught medical students, residents, nurse practitioners, CRNAs, nurse midwives, a variety, OT, PT, all these different letters, but I think at the end of whatever's after your name as far as letters goes, we're all here to help patients, so I think that's an opportunity for us to all learn together and be on the same page as far as expanding what we know about both individual bedside health but also population health, which is kind of the topic here, and of course this whole conference in general. So as you can see, I'm pretty heavily involved with APHA, for better or for worse, from my perspective or theirs, but I love APHA, so I'm happy to be here. I have no, I have nothing to disclose, no affiliations whatsoever, no paychecks or anything. It's all volunteer, part of my parole. so I want to instigate something here, thinking about big picture and what that means, and I want to tell you that I myself am clinically trained as a physician assistant, but I've held administrative roles in a variety of settings, working in healthcare delivery on the front lines for a department, for a division, doing quality management and improvement programs in hospice and palliative care and a few other settings. And so that's sort of my clinical slash public health slash health administration background. And what I've noticed, I'll talk about my embarrassment briefly, okay, is when I've worked as a frontline provider and I've seen not just physician assistant colleagues, but other colleagues as well, they're crackerjack at the bedside. You know, the central line, boom, it's in. They're talking with the patients and the families, and everybody just loves them, and they're just wonderful, and they're great. And they have to interact with the health administrator or the department administrator, and they're all thumbs, all tongues, whatever you want to call it. They don't know how to walk the walk, talk the talk when it comes to some big picture issues. You know, patient satisfaction scoring, reimbursement issues, payment issues, healthcare and service workflow issues. And so they don't really get it when it comes to that. And so I think that's what in me was the impetus to make sure that I got the training and education myself, but then also imparted it onto my PA students and others. My students, speaking of, I think they have an opportunity with the education that we give them, and I think in your programs and so forth, if you expand population health, you have an opportunity to give them a bigger picture view. You also lay track, I think, for administrative posts, which many will progress to, for education, teaching posts, which many will find themselves in, and also research as well, because a lot of our curriculum and other you know, public health related curricula give that research background and grounding. So with the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, we have a lot of shifting sands, and there's things that still have yet to be realized. There's portions that have yet to be put into play entirely, and it's still very new. But there's opportunities both embedded within the structure of the PPACA, but also as a result of, because of the domino effect, that will have implications for non-physician providers, quality improvement programs, EMR expansion, tailoring care to a culturally diverse population, which is a big focus of mine. I live in New York City. There's over 800 languages spoken every day in the boroughs. I mean, it's a crazy place. It's a great lab to teach students, but it's also a wonderful place to practice both as a bedside clinician, but also a health administrator, a healthcare administrator. You may also find, I don't know how many of you are officially attached to a training program, but you may take, you know, you may dig down into some of those requirements and find that they want you to cover some of these public health oriented, even though they might not say public health, or they may not say population health management. You may want to dig down and see what they require, because, in fact, they may be requiring a bolstering of your public health or big picture-oriented curricular components. So be on the lookout for that. And if you don't see it now in your profession, you're bound to see it fairly soon is my guess. We have it for the accreditation organization for PAs. We definitely have it. We need to cover this stuff. Okay, so whether I enjoyed it or not, it's still required. So happens I enjoy it. So some major public health skill sets that you're probably already basically familiar with, and of course there's others, but these are some buckets, okay? Biostats, epidemiology, health behavior, environmental and occupational health, and health policy and management, okay? Those are big and broad, and they contain a lot of different subsets, and we'll take a look at that briefly. I want to also offer to you an interesting framework that came out a while back, but I still think is pretty relevant. And I'm just going to focus on the population health-oriented recommendations of this interdisciplinary researcher group that came together and put together these recommendations looking at clinical prevention and pop health. There is a whole set related to clinical prevention and specifically, which of course is intertwined with population health, but the next few slides give us a little taste of what they recommend as population health content in your various programs. So evidence-based of practice, which is awkward wording, but that's what they use. Clearly, epibiostats, outcome measurement, health surveillance, determinants of health. I think a lot of this stuff in various educational programs, medical and health professions training programs, touch on a lot of these, but maybe we're not always so mindful about exactly how we're covering them. Health systems and health policy. That's for the administrator. I want to take care of patients. I want to be at the bedside. I want to take care of patients. Well, it helps for you to know the lingo and to have a sense of what people, many times your boss, is worried about on a day-to-day basis. So it's important that trainees kind of have a clue as to what's on the radar of their boss or of the department administrator. Okay, and many times it may not be a clinician. Who also has an MBA or something, who's at the helm of a division or a department or a hospital. Sometimes it's a physician, sometimes it's a nurse, but many times it's even somebody who spent years working in retail sector or something, and they're just crackerjack and they get recruited for the healthcare and now they're switching their paradigm. But it's up to you to sort of be able to bridge that gap, I think, as a clinician and make sure they understand the issues and that you understand some of the things that are on their radar as well. So I think including some of these subsets of information for health systems and health policy can really benefit a practitioner. Community aspects of medicine of practice, again, you cover some of this in a lot of your training programs, and if you trained, you probably covered some aspects of this, but I think a few of them get short shrift when it comes to some of the curricular components. Cultural dimensions of practice, again, I think no matter where you are, that's relevant, but if you find yourself in a very diverse place, like an urban center, for instance, that's really important. And maybe even if this were a prioritized list, in my mind, that should be up higher if that were the priority. Community services, I think as a primary care provider, and no matter what letters are after your name, but if you're providing care to of a primary nature and preventative nature to people in the community, knowing what they can access after they leave your clinic or office door is really important. And I think there's often a big disconnect. We don't know. We sort of, well, I'm doing what I got to do, and then they get back into their community, and it's all lost because there's no follow-up, there's no support services, there's economic legal issues. They can't pay their rent, so they're not showing up to the clinic because they're working on something else. And so there's various things that I think we can be aware of as practitioners. In our, at Toro College, in our public health, I'll call it a public health-oriented master's curriculum, when I came on board, we had some of these components, but I felt like it needed more bolstering. We sort of do a bachelor's MS a joint degree in 4 years, and they come in with some undergraduate credit. And so we actually have singular courses with those titles, most of which I teach, but I have some other faculty teaching them, some of which, like evidence-based medicine and portions of medical ethics and health policy, is taught online and pretty successfully, because at that time, where it falls in their in their education, they're actually on clinical rotation. So other than, you know, callback days we have at the end of every 5 weeks, you know, or 6 weeks of rotation where we have a capture point, the rest of the time they're off, you know, at any number one of the hospitals that we train at. And we have over 150 sites around the tri-state area. So they're, you know, it's hard to capture. That's why the online components are really beneficial. And there are certain topics. I don't think that clinical medicine topics can be taught online very well. Some people would argue with me, but I don't really. I think you need to be face-to-face and have hands-on. However, some of these topics I think you can successfully do online and get those concepts put forth to your students. So we have five major courses, and then there's a capstone paper, but the capstone paper isn't necessarily about treating, you know, a certain set of dermatologic, you know, findings. This could be something that's clinically oriented like that, or it could be something that's healthcare delivery oriented. Maybe it's about workforce enhancements. Maybe it's about the role of the non-physician provider in providing such and such. And so I try to expand that capstone paper to include things, A, that they're interested in, because I tell them, if you're not interested in this, it'll be pure drudgery, and I'm going to be bored as heck reading your paper, and so will your advisor. So make sure it's something that entices you, and it can be something that's public health, population health oriented, and a lot of my students just love that, because they're going to school to be a clinician, but they really do want to explore some of the bigger picture issues of today. And then we have a seminar at the end, which is everybody's invited to, but there's a selection of students who present there. And again, the topics are reflective of their master's paper, and so and that can run the gamut from clinical topics to healthcare delivery issues. Some special topic areas that I've already started exploring in my program, and it would be great to see other people doing it. I know other people are doing it. And a few of them I want to develop further, but end of life and palliative approaches to care as a public health concern is a big personal, professional and research interest of mine, and so I incorporate that. Organizational ethics, we have a medical ethics course, but then we go into a bit about organizational ethics because we're all working in teams, we're all working in organizations, and a lot of that comes up. The individual parts may think that they're the most ethical and the most just in what they do, but as that machine rolls forward and cares for patients, we need to be on the lookout for some other ditches in the road. Transnational healthcare workforce migration. I mean, we, in our PA program alone in New York City, we have people who have English as, you know, a second and third language. You know, in the provider population itself is very diverse, and the people we serve is very diverse. But I think there's a lot of workforce migration issues that students in my program themselves have actually experienced, and so it's personal, but it's also relevant to practice, and culturally, you're going to keep on hearing culturally attuned. At the end of the session, I'll run back in and I'll say the word culturally attuned again. Delivery of culturally attuned, growing U.S. plurality is a really a big issue. I think we need to speak to it better than we are. QI, language, it's a whole other language on top of anatomy, physiology, you know, medical terminology. Quality improvement is important, and I think that bedside clinicians play a critical role in making sure that QI processes are done correctly and carried out properly. Looking at the expansion of roles of non-physician medical providers is a big topic of mine, and looking at how they can enhance roles in QI and PI, patient-centered medical homes, the affordable care, accountable care organizations, which are written into the PPACA to some degree, but still not, you know, fully understood yet. IPE, or interprofessional education, is big on our agenda as well as a school of health sciences, but also in our program. And that's important to us. Comparative health systems are also of interest because there's a lot of criticism over our own about the PPACA, for instance, and we want to sort of compare and contrast and see how the rest of the world is encountering some similar challenges and how we might be better off or worse off. So I think that's an important piece of the big picture. Student feedback, very briefly, so far, just based on course evaluations and so forth, is that in the didactic stage, or when they're sitting in a classroom, they're often surprised. So they have these aha, you know, moments. You know, I actually have this little chair that I have a little labeled thing that says aha on it, and I ask them to put their ahas anonymously in a piece of paper, and I'll read them out to the class, because oftentimes they'll have, they'll put two and two together. You know, they'll be on clinical rotations, and then they'll be in classroom, and they'll go, oh, shoot, that's what that really means. Or I read about this in, you know, my book, and then I saw this in class, or vice versa. So they're often surprised about the connections that they make. I do a lot of peer teaching of finite topics, not like a whole chapter, but we'll take like a concept in epidemiology, and I'll actually have them in pre-assigned breakout groups, and they'll break out for, you know, 25-30 minutes and discuss it in the group, and then come back and just have at it, and stand up on stage and let us know what they've learned, and we have a discussion around that. I also have them in medical ethics and health policy do a healthcare consumer interview of about an hour to an hour and a half, where they actually focus on injustices that person has perceives that they've experienced in the healthcare system, and explore that with the individual, and then write it up anonymously. And a lot of the students believe that has really led to a greater understanding of some of the challenges that healthcare consumers have in our wacky non-healthcare, non-system. Clinical rotation stage, this is where they're really putting it together. They're excited to be there, but they're also seeing the harsh realities of clinical practice and some of the results of where we put money in care and workforce, education, for instance. And then after graduation, they're coming back to me. Our postgraduate surveys show that they have a better understanding of some of these big picture issues than they did a few years back, when their program wasn't as bolstered as it is now. There's always room for improvement, but I think we're making strides. So I do feel like the feedback from them is that they're able to walk the walk and talk the talk. You know, when they interact with a healthcare administrator, they sort of get it. They're able to speak that language. They know it's on the radar of those looking at, you know, who have the 30,000 foot view of the organization. I think there's different things you can do. 1 minute, sorry. Okay, there's different things you can do, and I can get these slides to you. I call it an epi drive-by. We take an epidemiology topic, and we'll do it at the bedside. Okay, you can do hospital administrator-led presentations that focus on some of those bigger picture issues there. There's also some cases you might want to check out that I have used and are very useful. And the IPE piece, the interprofessional collaboration piece, I think is really important for both students and staff in the workforce for getting a handle on the bigger picture. So partner with those who maybe you don't have those resources in your department, so partner with others. Look for people who could teach, you know, singular topics or a singular session on some of these skill issues. You can cross-train your current faculty. Online components, I think you can use thoughtfully. I'm not a huge fan of online education, but I think some of these topics can lend themselves to that. So I'm going to put, you know, that's my disclaimer. And student peer teaching, I think, can be really important. There's been great feedback from the students doing some of this peer teaching on finite concepts in class. So thank you very much. I think we're going to do a question or two. In the back? Oh, sorry. Well, it's a Master of Science in Physician Assistant Studies, so that's the actual degree, so it's not an MPH, and it is a requirement for graduation from the program. Correct. Well, it's intertwined. Most of it's towards the end of their curriculum, but it's also intertwined with their clinical education as well, didactic and clinical rotations. Correct. But they don't do a full bachelor's. They come in with 40 credits already in basic sciences, so they sort of hit the ground. You know, it's like Scooby-Doo and Shaggy. Their feet are already running when they hit our program, and they're off. I have about 17 or 18 credits a semester. It's brutal. But that's how it is nationally. I'm sorry, I didn't quite catch the trail end of that.
In other words, you know, your case of medical ethics, are they like real cases you kind of got from some institutions or literature searches or it's more relevant because ours was just not relevant.
Right. Yeah, I mean, we take them from a variety of cases, and I'll take them from, I worked in critical care medicine for a bunch of years, and so I'll take them from my own experience or from other faculty members' experience. So you have a hospital ethics committee, and you could actually draw from some cases from that, anonymous cases, or okay, great. That's great to have that resource. Yeah. Other questions? Yes, sir.
I can imagine you having the students writing letters to the editor around the cases that they're getting.
Right. Yeah.
Working with
the patient. Yeah. Yeah, that would be interesting. They don't have any extra time for that, but they would kill me if I also lumped that requirement on top of them. They're all about to jump off a bridge already. But as a public health policy guy myself, ooh, that makes me so happy if they did that, right?